supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, there's a new pest in town, and it wants to defile your raspberries, blueberries, strawberries, and other thin-skinned fruits. We'll tell you how you can try and battle these pests when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, so we're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Melissa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you today?
I am just ducky. Melissa, how you doing?
I'm lovely. Thank you for asking.
Well, isn't that wonderful? Where is Melissa Lovely?
I am calling from Norman, Oklahoma.
Stormin' Norman. We love our friends down in the Oklahoma City area. I had such a great time there this spring. I know people are tired of hearing me talk about it, but you really know how to throw out the red carpet down there.
We have a lot of fun. There's a lot of really interesting things to see and do in Oklahoma City. It's a great place to be.
All right. What can we do for Melissa in Norman?
Well, I work in a restaurant, and it's a pasta restaurant. It's steamy. It's hot. But we have this ficus that has been there for as long as I've worked there, which is going on 10 years now. It's the world's saddest ficus. it honestly is. It doesn't die, but it doesn't really live either. And it's still got leaves. It still like produces leaves and grows and everything. It gets taller, but it's kind of in this perpetual state of existing. And I feel so bad for it. But I was just wondering how I can kind of get it back to life, like really get it thriving.
Well, how tall is it?
It's about 5 feet tall.
Okay. And what kind of light does it get?
It gets an indirect sunlight. It's at the front of the restaurant, and we just have its open windows all along the front, but there is an awning. And I don't think it gets any direct sunlight. It's just indirect sunlight all day long.
That's not the worst, but you say it's in the front of the restaurant. How many blasts of cold air is it exposed to every hour on a Friday night?
Yeah, that's a good point. Quite a bit, probably. It used to be directly in front of the front door. And so when people would come in, they would be bumping into it and standing around it and everything like that. And I've moved it more to a corner where it's still getting quite a bit of light. But yeah, it does. It gets hit with the air and the elements probably several times an hour.
Yeah, because Oklahoma City, I mean, your summers are beautiful, but your winters are cold. So
they're supposed to be. I mean, it's still like 60 degrees right
now. I'm sorry. I meant in the old world, in the Old Testament,
yes.
When we had seasons way back when in the 20th century.
Right, yes.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. Back to your sad little ficus. Who waters it? Is there any kind of a regular schedule? Is it possible that people are just emptying their coffee and wine into it every once in a while?
Hopefully not. That probably is a possibility. Hopefully not. It gets watered. I have it watered on Mondays and Wednesdays just because that's when I'm there usually.
Right.
I'm there during the week, and I don't want to overwater it. And honestly, I'm not sure. I've never really cared for a ficus before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did notice that I think it was getting too much water.
Yes.
For a while there when people were watering it every day. So I have people watering it. Well, when I'm there, I water it Monday and Wednesday, and I have it kind of like written down that please don't overwater our sad ficus.
Okay. Well, that's not any help. Please don't water our sad ficus is much better instruction because there's group irresponsibility here.
Yes.
You know, well, I'm not overwatering it. I'm just emptying these water glasses into it, you know.
Yeah.
So what kind of pot's it in?
I think it's about a 45-gallon. It's not a terracotta pot. It's kind of a plastic, but it looks like it's molded, but it's a really light pot.
Okay, good.
But I think it's about 45 gallons.
Good. And is there something underneath to collect the extra water?
I have a plate underneath it, yes.
And do you ever see water in the plate?
No, I don't.
Okay, that's a good sign.
They took it outside for a while and kind of hosed it down because it was a little dusty.
Right. Did it like that?
It seemed to. It really did. And then I told him to bring it back in because I thought it was going to start getting cold eventually, and it never really did.
It's not next to a heater?
No.
Okay. Here's what we're going to do. You're going to stop watering it. You're going to really let it dry out a little bit. I know a lot of articles will tell you water when the surface of the soil feels dry. That's a great way to kill plants. If you have something like chopsticks you can bring into the restaurant, shove it down in the dirt and see where the water line is. You really want this thing to dry out. But, you know, maybe what this puppy needs is misting. You can get them at a dollar store. You can get them at a garden center. You can get them at Wally World. Just a little mister, you know, put clean water in it. And every morning, you could give this puppy a spritz, really moisten the leaves. It'll make it look good. It'll make it look a little cleaner, more glisteny, more sparkly. And it really likes that kind of water. And especially as we get into winter and the indoor air itself is dry, it's like moisturizer. So try a combination of having a really light hand with the water, but you can mist that thing literally every morning, and it would not mind. In fact, I think it would like it a lot.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
All right, good luck.
Thank you, Mike. I love your show.
Oh, thank you so much. Take care.
You too.
1-888-346-9499. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing today?
I am just ducky, Joe. How are you, sir?
Well, I'm doing just fine, thank you.
And where is Joe Fine?
I am in Plato Center, Illinois.
Where is Plato Center?
It is near Elgin, Illinois, by the Fox River, just northwest of Chicago.
What could we do for Joe in Plato?
I have a little 16-acre farm. 11 of it's tillable, and I live on 5, and I've got a lot of large oak and a couple maples, real big ones. And at the base of them, they, for a long time, the guy that was taking care of the lawn hasn't did any weed eating. And now at the base of all the trees, I have, quarter-inch, half-inch trees growing right at the base. And I want to try to get rid of them without damaging the tree.
Yeah.
Or trees, I should say.
Right. Okay, so
I don't know if I should just cut them down and let the roots rot, or
there's two possibilities here. One, very common for some trees to send up what are called suckers, and these come from the parent tree. They come up for various reasons. Some trees just have a habit of doing it, and these new shoots are generally not productive. They suck a little life out of the parent tree, and they're unattractive. If I remember correctly, and I'm talking like a decade ago, our pruning expert, Lee Reich, was on the show, and he said when you have these suckers, if you prune them out with a pair of pruners, it stimulates them to regrow. But if you have the time to twist them off and snap them off, it doesn't stimulate that regrowth hormone, and that sprout will not come back again. Now, you can check me, and you can also get a little bit more information online. If you go to the show's website, youbetyourgarden.org, and go to Garden Answers A to Z, and then go to S for suckers, it'll also say water sprouts. Those are another form of adventurous growth that comes from a plant. And there'll be complete instructions on the best way to get rid of the suckers. But it's very good not to be weed whacking down at the base of a tree, as you may have realized, because the weed whacker can beat away at the bark of the tree. And then if it girdles the tree, if it takes the bark off in a complete circle, even a huge tree can die. So that's one reason that people mulch around the base of trees. They go nuts and they actually make a mound of mulch that encourages sprouts and stuff to come up and rots the tree. But the original intent for the circles of mulch was to keep lawnmowers and weed whackers away. It's just always been applied incorrectly. The other possibility is, because you're in a wooded area, you could have something like wild wisteria or other plants that sprout up out of the ground. You know, these, they're vines if they're left to grow long enough, but there's no reason they couldn't come up right near the base of a plant. Do you have a lot of woody vines in the woods?
No. These all look like little miniature trees coming up around everything.
Okay. Well, I would suggest, you know, there's always the possibility, because the trees you mentioned are not really known for sending up suckers, and suckers don't look like a tree. Suckers look like a stick kind of coming up out of the ground. These could just be baby trees that are growing from seed pods, in which case the solution would be, you know, when you see them around the base of the tree, soak that area with water and then just gently pull them up. They should come up roots and all if they're simply baby trees. And then you could take them maybe to an area that's been defoliated or deforested and stick them in the ground. See if you can get them to go. But I think really what we're talking about here is free trees.
All right. Well, I'll give that a try. I should do that in the spring, right?
Yes, when they come up.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, thank you very much for the info. Great show you have.
Thank you so much, Joe. Very interesting question. Thank you for calling.
Pleasure talking with you. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody in areas that dip below freezing that rock salt, often disguised by the initials NaCl, is the worst choice for plants, pets, and surfaces when ice is an issue. Instead, use play sand or alternative de-icers like calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, and potassium chloride. But don't go checking those labels just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your phone calls and the Wormy Berry Blues. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later on the show, there is a tiny little fly from Asia that landed here in 2008 and spread across the country, decimating raspberries, strawberries, and blueberries. We'll help you deal with the spotted winged terror when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Fifi, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Fifi. How are you?
I'm good. And you?
I am just ducky. Thanks for asking. Where is Fifi good?
In Milford, New Jersey.
Ah.
Near the Delaware River.
Yes, very good. The Garden State. What can we do for you?
I'd like to know more about wintering over geraniums. My Uncle Ed used to bring them in his garage, but I don't know if I'm supposed to cut them back now or in the spring, or if they need water at all, or if they need any sunlight?
Well, geraniums are typically very hardy plants. If we were to go down, for instance, to the Carolinas, we might just be able to leave them outside even. But in a New Jersey winter, they need to be protected from the worst of the cold. Now, I think with plants like this that are perennial, if protected from frost, I think the best idea is always to get them to be lush and healthy and look beautiful over the winter. If you have like a bay window, one of those kind of horticultural pushed out windows that gets a lot of sun from all sides.
Not really.
But for people who do, they can just put them in that window, keep them watered, and they should have new growth and flowers all winter long. If you have a, quote, sunny windowsill that doesn't get freezing cold at night and doesn't, like, have a radiator right underneath it, same thing. You can put the plants in pots in that windowsill. Keep it away from the glass because the glass is going to get cold at night. And that might not be enough light to really make them look elegant, but it would keep them alive, and you'd still have the new growth, which probably would be scented with geraniums. You know, there's so many different scented geraniums out there. If you wanted to mix and match, you could put a shop light, just a regular 4-foot long shop light, which now I'm seeing all over the place come with LED tubes instead of fluorescent tubes. And the lumens, the light intensity of these things is very good. They're really inexpensive to buy, and they cost almost nothing to run, and you're never going to have to replace the tubes. So putting them in a sunny windowsill with the fluorescent light on top, I guarantee, because that's a trick that I do, or LEDs instead of fluorescents now, you get a great show over the winter. And this isn't just kind of having fun. Over the winter, as you know, when the hours of daylight are really short, a lot of people get SAD, seasonal affective disorder. They get a little depressed just because we're not getting enough sunlight. And some people will even sit in front of these light boxes to get a couple of extra hours of sun-like light during the day. And I find having these extra lights on with plants blooming under them, I find it to be tremendously uplifting. If you don't want to do anything like that, take them down to a cool basement or a cool garage, someplace that's going to be in the 40s, low 50s, and water them occasionally, not too much.
Okay.
It's always best to water by weight. When you first water, really saturate the pot and then kind of rock it to see how much it feels like it weighs. And then if you go to check on those plants a month later and it still takes as much pressure to rock it around, they don't need water. If you go down and check them a week later and the pot suddenly feels super light, you water them. So much depends on humidity, the temperature, how the plants feel that day. But always trust your own instincts. When the pot is light, it needs water. If the pot's heavy, no matter how long it seems like it's been, it doesn't need water. And I've never seen the point of pruning plants coming in. You're really just stressing them even more. Obviously, there's a lot of stress of transplant shock or just being moved around shock. So the last thing you want to do is stress them even further, especially if you're going to be showing them off. In the spring, when they go back outside again, wait till all threat of frost is over. And then if you see areas that look a little ragged, look a little leggy, absolutely, you can cut them back. But at that point, you can't harm them anymore.
All right. That sounds easy enough.
All right. Well, everything sounds easy enough. I hope it works.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Joseph, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I am well today, Joseph. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thank you.
Where is Joseph great?
I am great in Howard County, Maryland.
Just outside of greater D.C., right?
Yes, sir.
All right. What can we do you for?
I just had a few questions about composting and vermicompost.
Worm culture. That's my favorite thing. My worm bin, especially in the wintertime when it's really too cold to be messing with food waste outside. I love my worm bin. Go ahead.
All right. First, I was going to ask about composting leaves. Is there a preferred container to store them in, or is any kind of container sufficient?
Well, when you're talking about fall leaves, the important thing is to shred them. And
right.
Any electric leaf blower has a reverse setting and a collection bag, so it's really easy to shred those leaves. And then if you're not going to add food waste to it, you're just going to make what's called leaf mold, then anything that contains them, any kind of a wire bin, animal fencing, anything that'll keep them from blowing around. If you're talking about adding food waste to the leaves, then what you want is they have these bins made of recycled black plastic that have locking lids. So you fill it up with shredded leaves, and then as you create kitchen waste, you mix the kitchen waste in with the shredded leaves, then you can lock the lid on these things so raccoons can't get into the bin. And the plastic is sturdy enough to keep out rats and mice and other problems.
I just recently seen your TED Talk video from Phoenixville. I don't know, it was a few years ago, I guess. But I was under the impression that the best way to get compost was strictly leaves.
Yes.
Now, is adding food waste, does that inhibit the process, or is there any difference between, like, specific food waste and leaf compost? Or?
Well, if you saw the TED Talk, and that's up to almost a million views now, that's just amazing. You see in the comments there's a lot of disagreement from people, and putting it mildly, huh? But, you know, I wonder how many of them have actually done this or realized the possibility of vermin. Outside in an open, unprotected pile, fall leaves alone will make excellent compost. You can really make better compost and make hotter compost and make it faster by mixing in a lot of coffee grounds.
And okay.
This is so great because, you know, the leaves are free. You're collecting them on your own property, shredding them. And then coffee shops, whether it's Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, or, you know, the local coffee shop, they are desperate to get rid of these grounds. The energy, the nutrients inherent in spent coffee grounds are enormous. They're filled with nitrogen. They're filled with calcium, phosphorus, potassium, trace elements. And otherwise, they're going to get landfilled. So the smartest thing is to mix a lot of spent coffee grounds with a lot of fall leaves, and you'll make one of the best composts that you can.
Okay, I was under the impression that if you filled a bin with food waste like apple cores, broccoli, lettuce leaves, and introduced red worms to it, that they could chew through that and digest that. Is that true or?
Very close.
No.
Indoor worm bins, because red worms are kind of tropical. They can't survive outdoors over winter. And even if we have another of these crazy mild winters and they do survive, they can't move around. You know, they're much slower. But having a worm bin indoors that has these red worms, red wigglers specifically, that you would add food waste to, but then you need something just to help the worms move around in there. So what's typically done is you'll put in a layer of food waste, then you'll cover that with shredded newspaper. And that keeps the worms in the dark, keeps things really nice and moist, prevents leakage, for lack of a better word, from the food waste. And it's amazing because otherwise, you know, composting paper would be a waste of energy because there's no nutrition in the paper. But the worms absolutely love it. And when red worms take that kitchen waste and digest it, they increase the nutrient content of that food by leaps and bounds. Scientists measured what the potential for fertilizer was in this raw kitchen waste, fed it to worms, and then analyzed it again. And the worms had doubled, tripled, quadrupled the nutrients, the minerals, the phosphorus, the nitrogen. It's just astounding what they do. They are tremendous recyclers and great soil makers. So, yeah, outside, shredded leaves and coffee grounds, inside, kitchen waste and shredded newspaper, and you'll have the most amazing-looking garden people have ever seen.
Really? Okay.
All right. Good luck, Joseph.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate your time.
Great to talk to you. Bye-bye.
All right.
1-888-346-9499. Edna, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for making it, Edna. Where are you?
I live in Yardley Borough.
Okay.
Bucks County.
Just outside of Philadelphia.
Right.
All right. What can we do for Edna?
I live on a well-traveled street, actually one block away from Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I have three things that died almost overnight, maybe a month or two ago. A maybe 15-year-old red maple tree,
oh,
a crepe myrtle that's been in at least 10 years, and a holly bush. The holly had been going gradually, actually, but the other two were fine. And I called you a couple of years ago because the same thing happened with the crepe myrtle that time, but it came back the following year. But now I have three things that have died.
Help me out here. What did I say a couple of years ago?
Well, you thought that perhaps someone had sprayed something in the area, possibly, that caused the crepe myrtle to die. I really was never sure what the problem was, but I was grateful that it came back anyway. But I just don't understand it. The only thing that I can possibly think of is my oil tank is under the front deck of my house, and it's not far from any of these plantings that I've mentioned.
It hasn't been worked on or anything like that.
No, no.
And, well, I mean, a slow leak would not really be noticeable.
Okay.
How long has it been in the ground?
I don't know, since I moved into the house over 30 years ago.
You know, since you bring it up, I'll suggest that the people who have the contract to deliver your heating oil, maybe even they do maintenance on the boiler itself, ask them to come out. There's probably a real simple something they can stick into the ground next to the tank and monitor to see if there's any oil content in the ground.
Uh-huh.
If there is, it's going to be an expensive fix, but it would be good not to be doing an Alaska pipeline kind of thing here.
Okay.
Let's back up a little bit. Are these plants in the middle of a lawn? Are they out by the street?
They're near the street, very close to the street.
They're near the street, and there's a lot of foot traffic in the street.
Yes, and motor traffic.
Yeah, but your plants are on the other side of a sidewalk.
There is no sidewalk on my street.
How close to your plants do people drive?
Well, let's say a little more than the width of a car.
Okay. Well, that would certainly lead me to suspect soil compaction. But on the other side of your plants is a lawn, correct?
No, actually, my land slopes down towards the canal. So the front of the house is on the street level. The back of the house is on the canal, which is way below. And there's just various plantings of ground covers going down this sort of slope towards the back.
But you definitely want something in front to kind of block the view from this heavily traveled street.
Yes.
Okay, so I will suggest soil compaction as a really probable cause. And it also sounds like this is a low area, so any water would settle there?
Yes, I guess so.
Well, first of all, you know, we'll know whether the crepe myrtle survived in the spring. The holly, if it doesn't look good now, that's a bad deal. Do you ever do anything for the holly, like put down peat moss in compost or a product like Holly Tone to keep the soil?
I've used Holly Tone.
Okay. All right. So it hasn't been neglected.
Well,
okay.
Maybe a little bit. But
all right. There isn't mulch up against the base of these plants.
No. Okay. I don't do that.
All right. You know, in the spring, we'll know who's dead and who's not. But the fact that the holly, I mean, this is the time of year where hollies look their best.
No, the holly seems to be totally gone. Really.
Yeah, that's a sin. If you have to replace these plants and you want something that's going to give you some screening and some privacy, I would suggest ornamental grasses. You could do a staggered line of ornamental grasses down there, kind of keep the car exhausts at bay a little bit, and they would be much less susceptible to the soil being a little bit compacted and maybe a little bit over wet.
Is there anything I can do about the soil compaction?
Yes. Normally, I would say in the fall for a lawn because it would stress the grass, but really, in your situation, you could get the soil what's called core aerated, C-O-R-E, aerated. They come by with a machine that pulls little plugs of soil out of the area, and that lessens the soil compaction, gets air down to the roots of the plants, improves drainage. It's a great all-around cure, and it's really one of the only things you can do when you've done everything else right and think the plants still don't seem to be thriving. So in your case, you could have a core aeration done in the spring. I wouldn't recommend that for a lawn, but you don't have a lawn. And if the plants don't green up, then removing them, having the stumps pulled and getting them out of there and everything, that kind of work would loosen things up, let people know your concerns. They can do some aerating at the time. And then it's your choice as to whether you want to replace them with more of the same or you want to go for ornamental grasses, which are going to be a little bit tougher in this situation.
Okay.
You know, they'll take the road salt better. They'll take the exhaust better.
All right. Well, I appreciate your reply, and we'll see what happens in the spring, I guess, and hope for the best.
All right. Good luck, Edna.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone with a cut Christmas tree in the house to get it outside ASAP. Carefully remove the ornaments, suck any water out of the stand with a turkey baster, and then lay the tree sideways on a tarp to get it out without a million needle drops. Then stick it out back, cover it with suet cakes, and give birds food and shelter for the winter. But don't go grabbing that tarp just yet, because we'll be right back to protect your berries and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week about a nasty new fruit fly, actually a vinegar fly, if you want to be technical about it, that loves to eat your sweet little fruits like strawberries, raspberries, and blueberries. We'll tell you how to fight this tiny terror after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Demetrius, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Good afternoon, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I just hope it doesn't get too cold too fast on me.
Yeah, well, that's if you got plants outside, it will. Where are you, man?
I'm in Nyanic, Connecticut, right off of Long Island Sound.
Oh, okay. Beautiful area up there.
Yes. No, I agree. And that's the reason for my phone call, because I live on a tidal creek, you know, saltwater estuary, and I don't want to use chemical fertilizers or chloride ice melts in the winter. You know, I do a lot of shell fishing, and so I sort of see some of the ramifications.
Let me just stop you right there, because you bring up a hugely important point, and one that I don't think I devote enough time to on this show. Where I live, I use calcium chloride to melt any ice that forms in the winter. But you're exactly correct. In your much more ecologically delicate area, any of the chloride should be avoided. And there have been studies showing that play sand, all-purpose sand, is very clean, very effective at building traction. And then when the weather warms up and you use a push broom to sweep the sand away, it actually improves clay soil. So this is the time of ice for our listeners in many parts of the country. And I apologize for interrupting you, but I wanted to drop that in there.
No. And that's actually, that dovetails exactly where I was going in terms of my question.
Go ahead.
So last year I found a zeolite product, a clinoptilolite product for ice traction.
Oh, okay.
And basically, they say just sweep it into your garden, sweep it into your compost because it has a high CEC. It's like a volcanic rock mineral. You know, sweep it into your gardens and you're going to have soil amendment attributes. And I guess I'm just wondering, you know, not a lot of people, I walk into my lawn and garden stores and they don't know what zeolite or clinoptilolite is. So
right.
I'm wondering what your feelings are on the subject.
Zeolite, it's kind of an obscure element. It's not really an element. It can be any of a number of different elements in kind of crystalline form. It occurs naturally, like perlite. It's kind of a volcanic glass. And the difference is that perlite is really neutral. Zeolite contains a lot of trace elements that are felt to be beneficial to plants. But there is nothing safer for your environment. I mean, it's used in water purification systems.
Yeah, some of the research that I've looked at, you know, I know it's used many different applications, water and air filtration mostly, and I think in animal feeds also.
Yeah, but isn't it expensive?
Well, relative to sand, yes, but supposedly it gives better traction using less, you know, a lesser portion. A spread rate.
Huh, that's interesting. That's one of the advantages of my calcium chloride. You use very small amounts. So there's no downside. If you want to buy a couple of bags of zeolite, and for those who are scratching their heads, it's Zeolite, and try it out, I think it would be great. The same thing I would warn you that I learned about sand is the only thing is if you use these kind of substances, you need one of those brushes at your door that you rub your boots or your shoes through before you go into the house to, so that you don't drag the grit in to your floors.
Because it's a little bit more granular, I don't have tracking like I did with sand.
Huh, okay, so you've tried it.
Yes, last year I tried it.
And it was effective and it was cost-effective and everything?
Well, it's pricier than sand, but this, you know, you use less. But it sort of embeds into the ice. It sucks up that thin layer of water, and it embeds, and it's very sharp granules, and they stick into the ice, and it doesn't track into the house. They say it doesn't harm wood floors. I have carpeting, but it works very effectively for ice traction.
You say you have carpeting. I mean, it almost sounds like it could be a flea treatment, like diatomaceous earth, to get these microscopically sharp particles into your carpeting would be death to fleas, should that ever occur.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, like diatomaceous earth, which is another mined product, this material is very sharp, as you say, on a microscopic level, and that would pierce the soft bodies of fleas. I think it would be great to sweep into the garden and great for your water there. And you've kind of enticed me. I might just buy a bag of zeolite and try this myself this winter. This sounds like a great idea. I certainly wouldn't mind getting some in my soil.
I thank you for your comments and in terms of your knowledge.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing up a great topic.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
All right, thank you, Demetrius. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jordan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I am just ducky today. Jordan, how are you, sir?
I guess I'm ducky as well.
And where is Jordan ducky?
I am in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Excellent. We love our listeners down there. You guys almost killed me with kindness when I was there this spring.
Hey, that's what we like to do here in Oklahoma.
What can we do for you, Jordan?
Well, I actually had a question about a pesticide content in compost. It's made from cattle manure.
Oh. So
the reason I ask is we buy a bag compost from a local business nearby, and they actually use a manure from a livestock sale barn next door. And I've heard that because of the cattle feed that they use in feedlots, you know, it might have pesticides on it because of all the pesticides we use on our crops. Do you know if that's true, that there could be pesticide in the compost product? And if so, how would that affect my garden versus, you know, my Bermuda grass growing outside?
Well, two things. First of all, you're right on track with the Bermuda grass, because you're not talking about compost unless the steer manure is just a small part of it. The steer manure, once it turns into soil, that's composted manure. And that's good for some crops like sweet corn and lawns. But it's not a good idea for fruiting plants like tomatoes or peppers. The high nitrogen content of manures tends to grow big plants, but it also tends to inhibit fruiting. So I know there's a lot of old stories about farmers fertilizing everything with cow manure and horse manure, and it's just not true, because you wouldn't get good yields. Now, unfortunately, confined animals in feedlots, their manure is actually pretty troublesome. They're being fed genetically engineered crops. They're being fed genetically engineered corn and soybeans. I mean, we know this because over 90% of those crops as grown in the United States are genetically engineered. So the problem there, it's been genetically manipulated so that it can withstand massive amounts of herbicides. So they spray the crops with herbicides at a level that would have killed the crops with one-tenth of that years and years ago, regular crops. But genetic engineering has enabled these crops to withstand doses of herbicide that are almost unimaginable. And that does pass through into the animal. Depending on the method of composting, some of it may be out of there by the time it gets to you. The way to test, and this is the way to test composted manure, municipal compost, anything like that, is you bring some home, and you fill just two flower pots. And in one flower pot, you plant nothing, but you water it. In the other flower pot, you plant some seeds, whatever the freshest seeds you have on hand are. Ideally, it would be pea or bean seeds. They're the most susceptible. But if the first pot doesn't grow anything, which is what you want, then the material is not weedy. One of the problems with both horse manure and steer manure is the digestive systems of the animals are very inefficient. And if they were allowed to graze out in the open and they ate weeds with seeds, that could pass through. So you want to make sure nothing grows in the first pot. And then if you get healthy looking plants in the second pot, then there's very little risk of high levels of herbicide being in the material.
Okay. That makes sense. We planted a little raised bed, and I used some of this material. I don't know how much of the cattle manure they use in their composting system, but we got our peas to grow, so apparently that batch was good.
Okay, yeah. Peas and beans, they're the canaries in the coal mine. And now that we've learned this, it's great, because the testing for herbicides and pesticides is hugely expensive. With this, you can do it at home, and it doesn't cost a lot of money.
Exactly.
All right, Jordan.
Well, I appreciate you answering that for me. I was kind of curious because I'd heard it, but I didn't know, you know, if it would come through. But your suggestion of, you know, just go ahead and test it out in two different pots, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's the easy way. All right, man, good luck. Have a good season next year.
Hey, you too. Have a good one.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Shockingly, producer Alexis Landis is not with us this week. What are the odds of that? I'd say 1 in 3. So this week, once again, we have the honor of the help of our intern, Robert Fogarty. But sadly, it's Robert's last day on the show. He has to move on. So we're happy to have him read the question of the week with us, but we are going to miss you, Robert.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. Get started, kid.
Okay. Rosvita and Emmaus PA writes, I know that you're a fellow raspberry fan, and I hope you can help me. I was picking loads of berries this past fall, but unfortunately they all had little white worms in them. I'm wondering which insect is the culprit and what I must do to try and save the next harvest. Any suggestions would be much appreciated. Her garden's pretty close to your place, right? So are there any worms in your berries?
No, but man, I think about it all the time. My local organic gardening friends have had to pull out and destroy their canes because of the same problem. The spotted wing Drosophila, a tiny new pest from Asia. Most people would call it a fruit fly, but it's technically a, quote, vinegar fly. The females have a hypodermic-like appendage they use to shoot their eggs into the interior of fruits that are just beginning to ripen, especially blueberries, strawberries, and raspberries. Eventually, little worms hatch out. They eat some of the fruit, but they live so deep inside that they're generally not discovered until those fruits are harvested and ready to go on top of your Cheerios.
That is beyond gross.
Especially if you're a small-scale market farmer and those, quote, worms start crawling out while potential customers are examining your wares.
Well, you're calling them worms, which is a common name for many pest caterpillars. But these are the immature form of flies, so they're actually
Well, let's just call them larvae and keep what little audience we have left. Now, according to the Michigan State University Extension, the tiny but distinctively covered flies first showed up in California in 2008, have become widespread, and are seriously hard to control because of the way the female literally shoots her eggs into the center of ripening fruit.
So what can home gardeners do then?
Well, the first thing is to set up monitoring traps. We'll go into much greater detail in the printed version we'll post at the Gardens Alive website. But essentially, you hang a yellow sticky trap inside a big cup that has tiny holes punched into the lid, and you put liquid bait in the bottom. The bait is a mixture of water, yeast, and sugar that ferments and attracts the flies.
And checking the traps lets you know when the flies have arrived in your garden, right?
Exactly. Now, so far, these pests are typically showing up fairly late in the season, so it's crucial to not mow double-bearing raspberry canes back to the ground in the fall. There's a good chance that the early harvest in late spring might be totally unaffected. Conversely, some growers might want to deliberately sacrifice the traditional fall crop so as to not give these pests a breeding ground.
What about strawberries and blueberries?
Well, June-bearing strawberries are harvested well before the flies appear, making them a much better choice than ever-bearing varieties, which ripen up throughout the season. Gardeners in regions under attack may also want to choose blueberry varieties that are early ripening and/or types that have the thickest skins, as these pests prefer thin-skinned fruits. No matter what, you want to keep the bait in your traps fresh. And if you start to catch the pests, pick your fruits promptly and immediately refrigerate the harvest. Turns out that cold slows the development of the eggs. Freezing might even kill them. In addition, get rid of any visibly damaged fruit by putting it in sealed plastic bags and letting those bags sit out in the sun.
Are there any safe sprays for this pest?
Yeah, there are approved insecticides for both chemical and organic production. But they're not very effective, you know, because the little eggs are inside the fruit. And they're all toxic to beneficial insects and highly toxic to the bees that are essential for pollination. And raspberries, for instance, always have new flowers opening up to be pollinated. But some blueberries have more of a flush of flowers followed by a flush of fruit. So I'd certainly consider spraying them with one of the spinosads, an organic insecticide that's approved for use on this pest and is otherwise harmless, as long as all the flowers are gone. You might want to even pull off a couple of last flowers to be able to spray the ripening fruit.
So, can you screen them out?
Yes and no. You'd need a very tight mesh row cover with ridiculously small openings. These flies are really tiny, and it would have to be sealed tight, like in a well-managed hoop house. And then, of course, you'd have to introduce honeybees or bumblebees for pollination.
Mike, what about trying to intercept them all with a huge number of traps?
Well, you know, the Michigan Extension actually suggests this for small gardens, and it's worth a try. You'd start with just a few traps early in the season, and then when you can verify that you're capturing spotted wing Drosophilas, pile on. The actual traps are homemade, and yeast and sugar are cheap, so the biggest expense is going to be your time. And still be sure that your harvest goes right into the fridge, so any already laid eggs don't hatch.
That's disgusting. You'd still be eating fly eggs.
Well, you know, you'd be shocked at how much of your food contains a little rogue protein inside. It's not going to harm you, and the flies can't breed inside of you. Well, that sure was some potentially helpful info about the newest berry pest in town, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail with lots of links and more detailed information, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to ravage my raspberries if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you are certain that we do not need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you live and where you will find the answers to all of those questions you are going to ask us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Terry Murray is our brand new vice president of production. Our old engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page and like us. We like our webmasters, Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz. Alexis Landis occasionally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia whenever she feels like it. Our associate producer of Production Association and this week's actual producer is Brett Rader. We must say goodbye to our intern, Robert Fogarty, boo-hoo. But we say hello once again to Elizabeth Perez Luna, who is back with us this week. Our editor, Al Banks, he's always been here. As have I, your host, Mike McGrath, which is why I will be here to see you again next week. Who's eating homegrown greens right now in places where winter really means winter? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss extending the season with a French hotbed. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden.